Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, January 27th. This morning we sit down with Senate President Ron Kochi to talk about the State of the State address and the start of the legislative session. We hope to also hear from the House Speaker later this week. And can Kauai Coffee Company strike a deal with its new landowners? Time is ticking on a new land lease as hundreds of jobs hang in the balance. We hear about new programs to help first-time homebuyers here in Hawaii. We also take a look at other proposals to help build new housing and fill units already available. Plus, lawmakers are wrestling with extending the federal budget as the possibility of another shutdown looms. We check in on how our wildlife refugees are faring from last year's cuts. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Playing it safe, that's a takeaway from Governor Josh Green's fourth State of the State address. We invited Senate President Ron Kochi to sit down with us to talk about the governor's plan to pause the tax breaks he had proposed to help with the cost of living. Kochi says he wants to see more details. Here's what he said about Green's speech.
It was very aspirational, but it's the 16th State of the State that I've listened to in person as a state senator, and most of them are. They're usually not filled with a lot of details, and the details come in, you know, the administrative package. I'd signed all of the bills yesterday right after the State of the State. So now we're getting to look at some more details of what the governor's talking about. But we all agree that the cost of housing is top of list as far as the affordability of Hawaii, about keeping our people here and also recruiting employees to come to Hawaii, and the cost of housing is an immense obstacle because it's so high. Obviously, he has committed money for homelessness, which we recognize is still a problem. We've talked about mental health issues. And at this point, he acknowledged the lieutenant governor and her efforts to get more pre-K classroom seats, investing in K-12 and our higher education pathways to jobs, making sure there are vocational pathways in our high schools for those who are not going to college. But the plumber you absolutely need, and you pay more than your CPA in the hourly rate. So they are good paying jobs, and we need these craftsmen to make a go of it. And then really, how are we going to deal with the impacts of what has been happening on the federal level? So we've still not seen a spreadsheet about, you know, at 250,000 and below, how many people, and above, how much money would that generate if we forgave, or if we kept the tax break in place for below and we removed it from the top end. Right now, the governor is saying freeze everything, not this year, but in the next 2 years, and then redeploy some of that to help those who are challenged. And so at this point, it's really taking a hard look at what those numbers translate out to and what specific program will generate what specific saving or benefit for the most vulnerable in our communities.
But are you of the mind that that makes prudent sense to just pause it?
The prudent sense comes to you when you actually get to look at the hard numbers. Okay. And we've not got the hard data. The one thing that I think we're all walking aligned, the House, the Senate, the governor, lieutenant governor, is that in the big, beautiful bill, as they called it, the wealthiest in our country received a tax break. And policies that have been put in place are affecting the most vulnerable in our community. And so how do we make sure that the most vulnerable receive the benefit that the wealthiest have received? And I think we're going to put that lens to the decision making, and then whether it's continuing the break for whether it's 250, 300 and below and not above, or whether it's freezing everybody, but taking some of that money and redeploying it to the most vulnerable, and it winds up to be a better economic benefit for them. That way, that's where we'll be going. But again, the point is the wealthiest got a tax break at the federal level, and the most vulnerable have been so adversely affected with the policies right now.
What is it that troubles you, I guess, you know, when we see what's been happening in this past year, right, in under Trump 2.0? Is there any one particular issue? Is it the healthcare issue? Is it
no, the thing that, and I was asked this by the chamber when they did their walk around last week, Thursday, one of the participants. And what keeps me up is the fact that one tweet in the middle of the night can have such a dramatic impact. So the president tweets that we're going to take Greenland and the Dow drops 900 points. Now it affects our retirement system contributions because we need to hit 7% rate of return to ensure the pensions of all of our employees. But then for the individual in their 401k that they've been putting away for their retirement, the financial markets, now you have less money to spend. And it's all because of one tweet. Now, when he said that about Denmark, I happened to be meeting within a couple days with the head of the Las Vegas Convention Bureau. That triggered a dramatic cancellation of Canadian visitors to Las Vegas because they see them as being next. And then Canada is a very important market for us here in Hawaii. And so we were adversely affected, and all because of one tweet. So it's not specific like healthcare or SNAP or any of those things, but it's that what is the unintended consequence of the one statement, and it's way beyond just one area of impact. It impacts so many different areas and sectors. And then for us, because of our spot, we used to be the gateway to Asia and strategically located here in between the continental U.S. and Asia. But now foreign visitors are reluctant to come to anywhere in the United States, but we're impacted greater because of how many Asian visitors we would get, because they're not sure what would be the visa or passport situation. Would I be detained if I come in to Hawaii? You know, all of these things for economy is so dependent on tourism. There are a lot of negative impacts from all of this.
That keeps you up at night worrying what tweet went out overnight and what you will wake up to.
And 4:30, first thing I do is check how is the stock market doing today.
Yeah, it's tough because we are so interconnected. And I just came back from a trip to Europe, and I was really surprised at the coverage of the U.S. over there in Great Britain. It was just fascinating to watch how they see the decisions that are being made in the White House and what he does, what he says.
But the other thing I would say, you know, we have a Senate President's Organization nationally, and we went to Slovenia this past summer and met with members of the Slovenian parliament. But when they talk about what's happening here, and I don't know if you caught that in the conversations you had or overheard, but they talk about Americans. They do not talk in terms of Republicans and Democrats. And so while we're spending all of this time demonizing the other party, the world looks at us as simply America. And it paints the brush for every one of us being responsible for what they see as bad behavior.
Yeah, it's a very troubling time that we're living in. And yeah, we've got to be able to be nimble to react to whatever comes our way. But it's not easy.
Well, but I think a great example of being nimble and being able to react to take care of our community, how quickly we deployed the $250 one-month SNAP benefit so that those who were so dependent on it when the shutdown occurred, they were able to bridge that month of November. And if the shutdown happens again, which is being discussed right now, we would know how to go do that and take care of at least that community. And hopefully it doesn't come to that. You know, the shutdown affects at the end everybody. And, you know, with air travel being so important for us, the shutdown would just again create great havoc here and on our economy.
Yeah, we've got to keep our fingers crossed that cooler heads will prevail and they will work toward a settlement and that we'll not find ourselves in another shutdown at the end of the week. And you know, we've been hearing from Senate President Ron Cochi about his reaction to Governor Josh Green's State of the State address. We'll have more of our Senate conversation right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting musician and storyteller Ricky Lee Jones, performing songs such as Chucky's In Love, this Thursday in two sets. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Step into the sound after dark with After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's new late night music series, where each weeknight brings a distinct voice, genre, and sonic point of view. Music to soundtrack your life, After Hours. Weekdays from 10 p.m. to midnight on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from Kona Stories Bookstore on Hawaii Island, featuring live author events, in-person book clubs, and monthly story times for children. More information and schedule at konastories.com.
Let's get back to our conversation with Senate President Ron Cochi. The legislative session kicked off with a cloud tied to questions around $35,000 in a brown paper bag that ended up with an influential lawmaker. It came out of a federal bribery probe that sent Senator Kalani English and Representative Ty Cullen to prison. Here's what Senator Cochi had to say about this. Switching gears on you, we have just started the session, and I know there's been much made about a petition that Ali Silver put to both houses to address and to open a probe into what lawmaker are we talking about that took the bag of money, the $35,000. What do you want to say about the Senate's position on that petition?
Every member was put forward with the question of, is it you? And all 25 responded, no, it is not me. Everyone was also asked, do you know who that might be? And all 25 responded, no, I don't know who that is. Our position had been from the start that we have been working with the Attorney General, and the previous guidance was not to interfere with a DOJ investigation. But as of last week, Tuesday, the Attorney General has said that they will undertake the investigation, and it's really now for the Attorney General to tell us what the next steps are and where they are in it. But an investigation is now underway at the state level and not solely in the hands of the Department of Justice.
And what about the Senate's ability to do its own independent probe? That's within your kuleana. Why not do something of your own?
First of all, Senator Kehokalole talked about this last week, so we don't have the ability to charge anybody with a crime and have any kind of penalty consequence, etc., which the Attorney General has. We don't have any investigators, which the Attorney General has. Our attorneys are research attorneys who work for us in bill drafters, and would we need to get attorneys to be part of a cross-examination or interview of witnesses? And the Attorney General has all of that personnel available to them, and then it would be independent of the body. At that point, would there be questions about just how independent was the Senate in investigating potentially one of their own members?
And that petition then is not going anywhere in the Senate?
No. We received it and filed it after the Attorney General indicated that they were going to undertake the investigation.
And there has been some question raised about whether, if it's not a sitting lawmaker and it's someone who has left office and is, let's say, perhaps part of the governor's administration, I think different questions raised about would that create a conflict with the AG's office. And then we'd have no other avenue to pursue and get to the truth.
At this point, when it has happened at the county level, then they've turned it over to the Attorney General to prosecute. If the Attorney General feels there's a conflict, then I think they would need to check with Steve Alm or one of the prosecutors, and then maybe one of the county prosecuting attorneys would in turn take their place. But I have confidence that the Attorney General will do the job and be capable without conflicting out. And if it isn't a sitting lawmaker, then we are on that group of people who hopes that she would make that statement quickly, because until that happens, there's a cloud over everybody. And if it isn't a sitting lawmaker, it would help get that off of the plate, out of the way, so we can really focus on all of the tough things that we're going to have to do.
Okay, but this juncture, it's not going anywhere in the Senate, and you will let the AG?
Yes.
Do her work. I have to ask, we've been hearing a lot of stories and concern about the situation on Kauai, about Kauai Coffee and the leases. Is there anything you can share with us? Because, you know, those are a lot of jobs, and that's a key part of the economy for your island.
The most important message that I've conveyed after talking with the speaker to the owners is that part of that land was targeted to be the new landfill site for the county. And A&B, who was the owner at the time, indicated that is some of the rare Class A soil we have in this state. And they dedicated the land to the important ag lands. A key component of the important ag land designation is to take it out of important ag land requires a two-thirds vote of both chambers. And I've indicated to the owners, because there was some rumors that they're a development company and they were going to get the coffee company out so that they could develop the property, that there is no way that you're going to be able to get two-thirds of both houses of the legislature to upzone that land. And so if you're not able to work it out with Kauai Coffee, then I certainly hope you have a wonderful ag plan that will continue to employ people, but it's not going to be upzoned. So for those who've heard that rumors that they are going to try to get them off and develop it, I can assure you there aren't two-thirds votes in both chambers to change that designation. And we have very little Class A soil in Hawaii, and so that will continue to be dedicated for ag use. The other problem I see, though, to the specific employees is that they may have another coffee farmer that they are going to work with, but the normal model is you're terminated from Kauai Coffee. And now if it's going to be called McBride Coffee, because that was the name of the plantation, but McBride Coffee comes, now we want all of you back because you're experienced and know how to do the job, but you reapply and now you're day one seniority. And all of those years of service and seniority you built up, you lose everything. And not to be too far off track, one of the nice things about that Alaska-Hawaiian merger, for the union employees who were retained, they retained all of the seniority. And they did not go through a model where your old company no longer exists, we'd love to have you, we need the workers. But you're a day one employee with no seniority. The Hawaiian employees kept that, the union members. So I have also, besides the owners, the mayor, speaker, I've talked to Kauai Coffee and ILWU, who represents the employees. So hopefully there will be a path in which the employees would be needed. There would be a continuation of the coffee operation, and hopefully their benefits would not be impaired too much.
That was Kauai Senator Ron Kochi, who stopped by our studio this morning. We also extended the invitation to talk with us to House Speaker Nadine Nakamura. We hope to hear from her later this week. The uncertainty around Kauai Coffee Company hangs in the balance. And here to talk more about that is Civil Beats Kauai reporter Noelle Fujii-Orede. Good morning, Noelle.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so much uncertainty.
Yeah, there definitely is. And right, that is the big question, is what's happening with Kauai Coffee Company? What's going to happen on Kauai? Our county council chair, Mel Raposo, is going to be meeting with Kauai Coffee and then the landowner, Brubaco Capital Partners, a Colorado-based investment firm, later this week in separate meetings to try and sort things out. Earlier this month, Kauai Coffee did notify folks that it's going to be laying off its employees between March 14th and March 28th. As far as we know, negotiations for that land lease are still ongoing. And the landowner, Brubaco Capital Partners, they did say that they're committed to retaining Kauai Coffee employees and that Kauai Coffee's 3,700 acres that are designated as important agricultural lands will continue to be used for ag. BBCP has also formed a Kauai Coffee Transition Task Force to ensure that planning for any transition is aligned with community operational and regulatory considerations.
We are talking about a lot of employees, 140 workers, and I know when we talked to the Senate president earlier today, he was concerned that if they are hired back by the new company, that their seniority and the salaries could be affected. But yeah, what else so did you learn in your reporting?
Yeah, because of all of the concern about Kauai Coffee, the county council did invite the company to present at a meeting earlier this month. And so that's where we got a better understanding of who exactly these employees are, right, that are being impacted by the situation. And so about 30% of Kauai Coffee's employees have been with the company for over 10 years. Three of them have been with the company for 50 years. Many of the employees have plantation roots because that land, before it was used for coffee, it was used for sugar. And roughly 90% of the employees live on the west side. And so Kauai Coffee, I mean, you've probably heard in conversations with others that it's an important component, right, of the west side community and of the culture. And it's a major employer, right, for the area as well.
Yeah, and you had a chance to check in with Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami as well?
Yes. I checked in with him and with State Rep D. Morikawa, whose district includes the Kauai Coffee land. Both of them just said that there's not much that county or the state legislature can do since this is a private matter. Mayor Kawakami said that he's been just trying to stay informed and understand the potential impacts to the Kauai Coffee workers. And then Rep. Morikawa, she just said that she's seen Kauai Coffee come a long way in the 40 years she's lived on the west side, and just said that Kauai Coffee has also just been a good neighbor and engages in sustainable farming practices. And Kauai Coffee does have a community impact aside from providing jobs. They also have an employee-led committee that has given back about $373,000 to Kauai since 2023.
When we're talking about the coffee trees, I mean, 4 million trees, that's a lot of trees.
Yes, that definitely is. And I know there's a lot of concern, too, with if Kauai Coffee were able to find other land potentially, but that's a lot to, there's a lot of equipment to have to move, and, right, that would be a lot of trees that they would have to replant, and it takes several years for these trees to be able to start bearing fruit, right? So a lot of folks are hoping for some type of resolution to this.
Yeah, so what's the next step? We just keep on top of these talks?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it's just waiting to see what happens, what comes out of conversations from Chair Raposo's discussions with Kauai Coffee and the landowner, and yeah, just wait and see for right now.
Anything else you think we need to underscore?
So these lands have been listed for sale since 2024, and that listing is technically still active, like its website is still active. And one thing I found on that website was that they said 695 acres were designated for urban development. And I think that's what has a lot of the community really worried about, oh, could this become another Kukui'ula? But they actually have that number wrong. Only 48 acres are designated as urban. The rest of it is agriculture or important ag lands.
Interesting. Okay, there may be a lot of hand-wringing, but as you mentioned, if the number's wrong, that threat is maybe not as big as people fear.
Yeah, at least for right now. So I asked BBCP about that, and they just apologized for using language that didn't reflect the most current planning framework. So, yeah, I just thought it was interesting because I asked the county planning department about that, and they were like, no, they probably misinterpreted it.
Thank you so much, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking with Noelle Fujii-Oride. You can read her story at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Today on The Daily, Christiane Tribert explains how a fleet of tankers secretly moves oil around the world and why their days may be numbered. I'm Rachel Abrams. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30 following Marketplace.
You know, we've been hearing much about the housing crisis that Hawaii is facing, and today we learn more about what the state is doing to help first-time homeowners get into the market. Dean Minakami is the executive director of the Hawaii Housing Finance Development Corporation. He sat down with us yesterday to outline what's available for local families to get a leg up and to talk about what bills are being proposed this session.
Our mission is to provide housing opportunities for Hawaii residents, and we do that in a number of ways. We have rental housing programs, we have programs that help for sale developments, and we recently launched a new home buyer program. It's called our Hale Kama'aina Mortgage and Down Payment Program. It's really great. It offers below market rate financing for first-time home buyers. Those who've been around in real estate for a while might recall it was called the Hula Mea Mortgage Program back in the day. It's been dormant for more than 10 years. But again, it offers below rate mortgage rates. So for government mortgages, such as USDA mortgages and VA programs, it offers rates as low as 5.4%. And for conventional loans, like Freddie Fannie loans, it offers rates as low as 5.65%. So below market. And the great thing is that the program has lower fees also. You might find lenders that offer comparable rates, but you're going to find that their points are higher. We just have a one-point origination fee, and that's it. And that rate and that fee is good for any home buyer who qualifies. So as long as you have a FICO score of 660 and you meet the eligibility requirements, you get that rate and that point structure.
And then when you talk about eligibility, I mean, do you have to be making a certain income level, average income level? How does that all work?
Yeah, good question. There are maximum income limits and purchase prices, but this is targeted towards working households. So the limits, they are fairly generous. It varies on household size. So if you're a family of three, for example, on Oahu, the income limit is about $175,000, and it can go even higher, up to over $200,000 if you're purchasing a home in what's called targeted areas or certain areas. As far as a maximum purchase price on Oahu, the price is maximum between $800,000 to $1 million, depending on where you're purchasing the home. The program is open now. You can talk to your realtor if you're working with them and tell them you want to learn more about the Hale Kama'aina Mortgage Program. And we have about 10 participating lenders. Some of the local banks include American Savings Bank. All the local lenders have expressed interest in participating, so they're all going through the process of signing up. But home buyers can go to our website. Maybe just Google Hale Kama'aina. That's the easiest way to find our program information. and you can read there how to sign up for this program.
And so tell us about the down payment part of this program as well.
Yeah, this program offers up to 4% of down payment assistance. We know that there are many home buyers or eligible home buyers who have sufficient income to qualify for a mortgage, but what's holding them back is the down payment required. So we have a program that provides up to 4% of the down payment amount in the form of a soft second loan. So as a soft second loan, there are no payments that are made on the loan until the owner sells the unit. So it's just a silent loan and provides 4% towards their down payment. And another great thing is that it's 1% simple interest, again, which they don't pay until they sell the unit. And after 9 years, if they remain in compliance with the program, the interest can be forgiven.
So this is really a way to be able to get our young people to get into the market, to get that first home, to build equity.
Exactly. When interest rates spiked up over the past 2 years, we saw that it was getting very hard for first-time buyers to get into the market, because when interest rates rise, it means the home buyers can qualify for much less. And home prices stabilized, but they didn't drop. So we needed to find a way to help, especially our first-time buyers, get into the market so they stay here in Hawaii.
And then are the, I don't know, requirements onerous? I don't know, because some of this stuff may seem pretty daunting to a first-time buyer.
They're not very onerous. You have to be a Hawaii resident. You have to live in the unit. You have to go through home buyer education, but that's offered through many providers such as the Hawaii Homeownership Center and other counseling providers. The requirements are not that much different from any other loan product, and we can close within 30 days.
Wow.
So the timeline also is very comparable to any other loan product that is being offered.
But that nut to crack, that down payment, like I said, is one of those barriers that most young families just, you know, because they're scraping by to begin with, paycheck to paycheck, and so it's pretty tough. What else? Any bills that you're trying to get in this session to tweak what you're doing?
Yes, there is a bill that seeks to create an inventory of affordable units that will be always available to local residents. It's been introduced as House Bill 1715 and Senate Bill 2070. You know, right now, if someone purchases an affordable unit under our program, it's subject to a 10-year buyback period, which means that they have to reside in the unit. The home buyer must reside in the unit for 10 years. If they want to sell it, say, after 5 years, we purchase it back from the home buyer at 1% simple interest. So one problem we hear about this is that home buyers, they don't want to commit to living in a home for 10 years, especially if it's a studio or one-bedroom unit. They might get married, they might have kids. It's a real commitment to say, I'm going to live here for 10 years. Another downside is that after 10 years, the homes go to market rate, so then they're lost to the affordable inventory. So we're looking at a new program where a buyer can buy an affordable unit and they can sell at any time, but the rate of appreciation will be tied to an index. And the index that we're looking at using is the long-term rate of appreciation for real estate. And on Oahu, that's been around 4.5% per year. So if this bill passes, then, you know, a home buyer could buy an affordable unit, and let's say after 3 years, they want to sell. Then they could, and they could sell it at 4.5% compound appreciation. So the intent is that the home buyer can gain equity, so they can move up the housing ladder.
Use it as leverage. That's great.
Unit stays affordable.
And yeah, so that bill, then you've got companion bills in both the House and Senate, but that's just another way to be able to help our young families.
It's a way to help our young families and to, over the long term, create an inventory of housing that will always be affordable to our local households.
And so what are some of the projects that you've been able to help finance that are coming up?
Projects that are underway right now, there's the Kuile Place, that's the high-rise condominium in the Moili'ili area.
Right on Kapi'olani Boulevard. Mm-hmm. Those were two- and three-story walk-ups, if I recall, and then now, yeah, you've got a high-rise going up there.
Yep. And also, sales are just starting now for the Kahuina project in Kaka'ako. So that's another, it's a mixed-use project, very interesting project. It has affordable rentals as well as for-sale condos in the building. And also in Kaka'ako, coming up later, is the Waiakoa project, another large condominium building. They haven't started sales yet, but they probably will start later this year.
And so the idea is that hopefully as we grow the inventory, we can help families, first-time buyers, get into the market, start building that equity, and grow along with their families.
Yeah, that's important. We also provide rental housing for those who can't afford to rent, but home ownership is so important to keep our workforce here because that allows them to grow roots here and to build equity and stay invested in Hawaii.
But the concept of what, rent to own?
Right. So we do have a rent to own program that we're starting up. We're getting our feet wet right now. We're purchasing 20 units in a condominium building in Kaka'ako, which we'll offer on a rent to own basis. We're also going to be developing our own projects to offer on a rent to own basis. And the intent is that we would offer units for rent at the same rates that tenants are paying now, so comparable to market rates, maybe even lower. And the great thing is that after 5 years or so, those tenants will have the opportunity to purchase their units. And while they're in the units, they'll be building equity because any proceeds that we receive in excess of our maintenance and holding costs would go back to the tenant as their equity towards purchasing the unit. Also, the sales price of the unit will be set up front when they first start renting. So they know what the sales price is. It's being set in today's dollars, which is also a huge plus. So again, this is a way for us to help folks on the path from being a renter to a homeowner.
Okay, yeah, I know we've got to try different things. You know, Hawaii, Department of Hawaiian Homelands is looking at rentals right for the first time with the Bolodrome project. But yeah, we just can't keep doing the same things over and over again. We've got to think out of the box.
Yeah.
Anything else that you think our listeners should know? I guess if they have children or grandchildren who may be first-time buyers and could qualify for some of these programs, so just get the word out.
One thing I'll note is for the down payment assistance program that I mentioned, right now, it requires that the home buyer put down 5% of their own funds to participate in the program. We know that can be a big hurdle because if you're purchasing a unit for $500,000, 5%, $25,000, that can be a big barrier nowadays. So we're looking at changing that statute. We have a proposal in to reduce that 5% amount to include the funding we're providing through our program.
Okay, all right, but at least you've got options.
Yes.
All right, okay. Thank you so much. We appreciate you coming down and help sharing this information, and we hope it will help our families.
Thank you, Catherine.
And that was Dean Minakami, Executive Director of the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation, talking about the various programs that the state has to help first-time homeowners get into the market. The first housing bills are up for hearing this afternoon. We'll have links to learn more about these programs on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, providing local businesses customized energy plans. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
President Trump has been pushing to double the number of Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents as part of his nationwide deportation program. The result? Lower recruitment qualifications, trainees who can't pass the fitness test, and agents in cities like Minneapolis using force that is often illegal. Who are the newest ICE agents, and how are they trained? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Let's face it. Life gets busy, but you don't want to miss out. HPR makes it easy to stay connected. Introducing the Akamai Recap. It's a quick roundup of local news stories sent to your inbox every weekday afternoon. It's free, and it takes just 10 seconds to sign up. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/akamai.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
You know, the next federal spending bill is in jeopardy as Democrats and a few Republicans are now balking at renewing funding for ICE in the wake of the killing of two U.S. citizens by ICE officers in Minnesota. Should the funding bill pass in its current form, it would have significant effects on other federal programs, including a $5 million cut to the budget for the National Wildlife Refuge System. The system is overseen by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the numbers show that previous budget cuts have already kneecapped operations. There are 10 refuges across Hawaii, including the James Campbell National Wildlife Refuge on Oahu, Kealia Pond on Maui, and Hakalau Forest on the Big Island. Nathan Marcy is the senior federal lands policy analyst for the nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about where Hawaii falls in the mix.
Funding levels for the National Wildlife Refuge System have been stagnant or declining now for a number of years. Really, they peaked in 2010. And since then, even when there's been a year-to-year increase in funding levels, those increases have not kept up with inflation. And there have been other increasing costs, increased visitation. So the effective funding level, sort of their purchasing power, has just declined steadily since then. And as a result of that, there had been a 30% decrease in staffing throughout the refuge system. And then when you come to last year at the start of the Trump administration, you know, as a result of the deferred resignation and early retirement programs that DOGE kicked off, you had an additional 25% roughly loss of staff. But that was on top of this long-term 30% decline. So the two things have combined to leave the refuge system now in a very precarious spot.
Put that into perspective. Why should listeners care about these pockets of federally protected wildlife?
So you can call them pockets. Some of them are quite small. Some of them are also quite large. But collectively, the refuge system nationwide is actually the world's largest network of protected lands and waters for conservation. And among the other federal land systems, you know, national parks and Forest Service and things like that, the refuge system is the only one of those land systems that is dedicated to wildlife. It is the only one of those systems that has a statutory mission that puts wildlife first. You know, you have refuges in at least one in every state and territory of the United States. They're in every ecosystem type, you know, from swamps to prairies to mountains, tropical forests, such as in Hawaii, tundra up in Alaska. And they've played a very crucial role in the protection and recovery of threatened and endangered species, which is important in many places, but as you know, particular importance in Hawaii.
Let's talk about some of those Hawaii refuges. On Oahu, people might be familiar with James Campbell National Wildlife Refuge. On Hawaii Island, there's Hakalau Forest. Give us a sense, what makes each of them special? What kinds of areas do they cover?
I'm not personally familiar with many of the refuges in Hawaii, with the exception of Hakalau, which I have visited. What I'm familiar with is the data, the species. We at Defenders have done an analysis to essentially rank all of the refuges, and there are 573 of them nationwide. We've ranked them based on sort of their biodiversity value, their importance to imperiled species, based on different data points, including just the number of threatened and endangered species on those refuges. And out of 573, Hakalau Forest is number one, based largely on its number of listed species, and in particular, the number of species, threatened and endangered species on that refuge that occur only there, no other refuge anywhere else in the U.S. or elsewhere in Hawaii. So it really is a very important refuge for that reason, just when you crunch the numbers.
Top of the list. And you would think then that would correspond to perhaps increased funding, not being hit as hard in the same way that we're seeing across the national refuge system. That is not the case. So tell us about some of the data that your organization obtained and what those numbers mean for Hakalau and also for the rest of the 500 some odd refuges across the country.
Sure. So the data that we have came from an internal review that the leadership of the refuge system did last year, in which they assessed the sort of staffing adequacy at all of those 573 refuges across the country. And they categorized them all into these four categories. The first one being refuges that have all the staff and resources they need. And spoiler alert, there are none of those. The next one would be refuges that have limited resources, that they're still able to meet some of their management goals, but not all. And then the third are those with insufficient resources that are not able to meet their management goals because they lack necessary staff. And then there's a fourth category of refuges, which they call shuttered, which may or may not actually be closed, but they may simply not have any staff on site. And so nationwide, as of July of last year, like I said, there are no refuges with full staff levels. 59% were categorized as having insufficient resources. And then just to bring it back to Hawaii, there are 10 refuges in Hawaii. 8 of those 10, 80%, have insufficient resources. So Hawaii is definitely worse off even than the nation as a whole.
And what kinds of effects are felt based on that staffing insufficiency, funding inadequacy? How do visitors feel that, or how do the refuges themselves experience these cuts?
That's going to vary from refuge to refuge, in part just because they're all unique, but also because it's going to depend on what specific staff individuals they have lost and maybe still have. But common effects that we've been hearing from refuges, one of the first things that often seems to be lost are the biological programs, you know, the things that are most important to us, of course, as defenders of wildlife. So things like the monitoring of threatened and endangered species, that is often one of the first things to go, followed by, you know, habitat management programs. But also maybe most visibly would be the impacts to visitor services. We're hearing oftentimes the visitor centers at refuges are either closed outright or their hours have been reduced greatly. They may only be open, you know, 1 or 2 days a week. Also, just the maintenance of facilities, of roads, of buildings, that is suffering. And even public safety and the safety of wildlife is put at risk when refuges lose their law enforcement staff.
Whenever I talk about refuges in Hawaii, I always talk about fencing. This is to keep invasive species out, mainly ungulates and rodents. Fencing costs a lot to maintain. It is not the most glamorous of jobs or things to brag about. And I think about how some of these numbers might play into these refuges' ability to maintain a strong fence and keep those invasive species out.
Yeah, that would absolutely be a problem. And I think one perhaps common misconception that I would want to correct is that refuges are not simply protected areas. It's not just that, you know, we drew them on a map and now they're safe. Refuges are intended to be areas that are actively managed, where you have biologists and other experts who are doing species surveys and managing their habitat, doing things like fencing, doing things like invasive species removal to actually maintain and improve the habitats of these species. And those kinds of things are necessary at refuges throughout the country. But, you know, as you mentioned, Hawaii has just such a particular problem with invasive species that I think it's fair to say that that kind of active management is more important there than elsewhere.
What do you want people to do with this information? What in your eyes is the solution? Because it seems like federally, the trend is less engagement and investment in refuges, not more.
Yeah, it's certainly true, as I was mentioning before, that there has been this long-term trend of a lack of investment in the refuge system by Congress, you know, by the folks who are deciding how agencies get funded. There are, I would say, some hopeful signs. Actually, the House and the Senate released their conference version of the appropriations bill for the Department of Interior, the bill that would establish funding levels for the Fish and Wildlife Service, including the refuge system. And I mean, I guess this is what counts as good news these days. The refuge system would only cut $5 million from it, which is good news compared to what the administration was asking for, which was a cut of over $100 million. So taking away an additional $5 million from the refuge system does not help with the staffing problem, but it's perhaps not quite the disaster that it could have been. And maybe even more encouraging than that is this appropriations bill includes a provision, basically it conditions that funding on the Fish and Wildlife Service maintaining adequate staffing levels to fulfill their mission, effectively do all of the different things that they are legally required to do, including management of the refuge system. It remains to be seen what that's going to do in practice, but it shows that there actually is a bipartisan majority in Congress who is prepared to push back against the administration. There are champions for refuges in Congress. And to bring it back around to your original question of what people can do, the reason why there are champions for refuges in Congress is because people have spoken up in defense of refuges, whether it's their local refuge that they enjoy visiting or just refuges nationwide. So the main thing people can do is just to make noise, to make themselves heard, to speak up for their refuges, even directly contacting their representatives in Congress and say that refuges are important to them, that wildlife is important to them, and that those things need money.
And is there anything else that you think listeners here in Hawaii should know about the state of the refuges writ large, or about the 10 here in Hawaii that are feeling the effects of a lack of investment?
The refuge system is facing a number of challenges. I think that arguably this lack of funding, lack of staffing and other resources is the single greatest challenge that refuges are facing, but it is not the only one. Other ones that we're tracking include things like land exchanges. I don't know of a Hawaii example, but there are others throughout the country where they're actually proposing to give away pieces of refuge land to companies or private interests, which is certainly of concern to us. And another thing that has come to light recently is that the new incoming director of the Fish and Wildlife Service is kicking off a review of the refuge system, which remains to be seen what the consequences of that are going to be. Perhaps some good things will come out of that, but that's definitely something to keep our eyes on. Rather than seeing these staffing numbers and realizing, well, the refuge system is not, living up to its obligations, it needs more resources and more staff, there's concern that perhaps they could look at that and say, well, there are too many refuges, the refuge system is not living within its means, and perhaps they might look at things like land exchanges or other things of that nature to even shrink the refuge system, which, of course, would not be a good outcome for wildlife.
That was Nathan Marcy of the nonprofit group Defenders of Wildlife and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links on our website to learn more about the funding cuts. And that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke, broadband and beyond. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.